So now I give you my longtime friend and helper, Dr. Lance Owens. There he is.
It's always good to have somebody watching your back, so Stefan, would you just watch my back? In November of 1960, 7 months before his death, C.G. Jung suffered what he called the lowest ebb of feeling I have ever experienced. He explained the sentiment in a letter to a correspondent in England thus, and I quote, "I had to understand that I was unable to make the people see what I am after. I am practically alone. There are a few who understand this and that, but almost nobody sees the whole. I have failed in my foremost task, to open people's eyes to the fact that man has a soul, that there is a buried treasure in the field, and that our religion and philosophy are in a lamentable state." End quote. C.G. Jung, November 1960. Looking back now over the last half century and more, it appears Jung had reason to lament. He had not been wholly understood. But the cause lay not just in the sprawling scope and the complex tenor of his massive amount of writings. In retrospect, it is evident that Jung had not revealed the whole. During his life, Jung consciously and cautiously elected not to publicly share the experiential key to his opus. He knew it too would not, at least not then, be understood. And the missing key we now see was his long sequestered red book, Liber Novus, the new book. Begun when Jung was 38 years old, and based on experiences which he carefully recorded in his journals between about 1913 and 1916, Liber Novus contains Jung's account of a life-altering journey into the depths of vision. At the commencement, he called his venture "my most difficult experiment." For over 16 years, Jung labored at calligraphically transcribing and illuminating a compilation from his journal record into the exquisite folio volume that thereafter was known as the Red Book. This was his buried treasure. It is the foundation of Jung's work and the Rosetta Stone to decoding his subsequent hermeneutics of creative imagination. Nearly a century after its composition, the publication of the Red Book, Liber Novus, in 2009, which is now just 4 years ago, has instigated a broad reassessment of Jung's place in cultural history. Among many revelations, the visionary events recorded there expose the experiential foundation of Jung's association with the perennial tradition of Gnosis, a praxis he identified as the historical antecedent of his psychology. To understand the whole of Dr. Jung, if we will now finally do that, it is imperative that we finally delve into the depths of his Gnostic vision and the way in which that ancient rhizome, that root, nurtured his life task. And I believe the time has now come. And based on my conversations with many people in the Jungian community, people who have been lifelong students of Jung, there is a transformative understanding, a new understanding of Jung developing at this time. The time has come. It is happening. But the foundations for that new understanding have been under preparation for many, many years by those few who foresaw this way that is now to come. I should perhaps start by recounting my own experience with Jung. And it was all instigated well over a quarter century ago by a fine gentleman seated here in this room. Of course, it's not too unusual that he would be seated here in this room on a Friday night, because he had been seated here in a room like this every Friday night, or most Friday nights, for the last 30 years or more, giving more. We won't say how much more. Giving fine lectures on numerous subjects, including on Jung. And my encounter with Jung really started with one of Dr. Heller's lectures many years ago. And it came coincident with another understanding, a study of, and an involvement in, the Gnostic tradition. Very shortly after I became engaged in my reading of Jung, within months actually, I came across, in fact I was given a copy, by the author of a book called The Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons to the Dead. That book has been a basis of my understanding of Jung for 25 years, and believe me, it is a wonderful foundation. For the next several years, actually over the next year and a half, I read most of Jung's collected works, and I've continued that reading for many years since. I cannot tell you how an understanding of Jung from the perspective of his Gnostic foundations transforms a reading of Jung's collected works. Understanding that at the basis, at the foundation of Jung's scholarly writings, there was an experience, an incredible experience, that this was the source of much that came forward. And of course, you know, we only had one piece of it at that time, one big shining star of it, which were the Seven Sermons to the Dead. But through Dr. Heller's instruction and his many other lectures, I perceived that this was but a summit popping up through the mists of history, that there was much more hidden that we would not at that time have access to. And of course, many of us have been very interested to know what the rest of it was, where this thing, these seven sermons, came from. It was clear that this event in Jung's life was the numinous beginning which contained everything, as he described it in his conversations with Agnella Jaffe near the end of his life. And a familiarity and understanding of visionary literature, particularly Gnostic material, is crucial to understanding Liber Novus. Those who are now beginning to attempt to understand Jung in this context, to read the Red Book, would benefit greatly from this sort of a hermeneutic, this sort of an experiential entry into the tradition upon which this book rests. You know, we've, over many years, particularly within the Jungian, you know, analytical, psychological community, there's been a great emphasis on terms and concepts, or Jung as a theorist, Jung as a scientist. But Dr. Sean Bassani, who spent 13 years working pretty much alone with the Red Book, you know, he was under contract, he was not allowed to say anything about what he was doing for all of these years, more than a decade that he was working on the Red Book, he was isolated with this book. Deeply in it. In fact, he said recently in a conversation published with James Hillman that he felt like he was locked in a jail cell with a ghost, Jung, and a Red Book. And he did not mean that just figuratively. That was his experience. Well, Dr. Shyam Dasani, when he gave his talk introducing the Red Book at the Library of Congress in June of 2010, he gave a talk about the visionary literature of Blake and of Dante. And he went on to say, and let me quote, "If, as Jung claimed, Dante and Blake clothed visionary experience in mythological forms, Could we not pose the question, did Jung in turn attempt to clothe visionary experience in conceptual psychological forms? If so, the power and significance of his work does not reside in his concepts, which are familiar to us, but in the visionary experience which was at the back of them. Think about that. It's not the concepts. It's not the psychological terminology in Jung that is important. It's the visionary event, experience, as Shyam Dasani calls it, which was at the back of them. And that visionary experience, I will suggest to you, has deep roots in the Gnostic tradition. You know, Jung's association, his connection with Gnostic tradition, has received comment over decades, and occasionally it generated controversy. Plentiful evidence regarding Jung's association, his familiarity and interest in Gnosticism, appeared throughout his published writings. More evidence came in comments he made in his seminar presentations, which are not so familiar to as many people, and some of which are just now actually being brought into general publication through the work of the Philemon Foundation. And then there was this little book Jung had printed in 1916 called The Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, The Seven Sermons to the Dead, which at a very early date robustly signaled the Gnostic foundation of his vision. Jung privately printed The Septem Sermones ad Mortuos in 1916, just months after he had transcribed this, what might be termed a Gnostic revelation, in his journals. In 1917, he added the Septem Sermones ad Mortuos to the last section of material he transcribed for entry into the Red Book. But in that transcription, he added to the sermons a homiletic dialogue between himself and Philemon, his spiritual guide, who he identified as an Alexandrian Gnostic. And we'll say a bit more about this Philemon in a minute or two, or more than a minute or two. In the 1920s, Jung allowed Helton Godwin Baynes, also known as Peter Baynes, to translate the seven sermons into English for Jung's disciples who did not speak German, because the Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, where the text itself was written principally in German. And this was printed in 1925, again for distribution. Numerous individuals working with Jung in those early years, in those decades, eventually read his Gnostic revelation. They knew about it. And so this question came up repeatedly in my own study over these years. Why was Gnosticism so little noted in the Jungian analytical community? Why weren't people talking about this? To me, in my own perception, it was a central issue. It was a key in reading Jung, to understanding so much. Why was it receiving so little attention, despite a work like the Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons to the Dead? Well, I've thought about this now in retrospect. I would maybe tell you there are a couple of reasons I could give you. First, in 1952, a fellow by the name of Martin Buber, a Jewish theologian, philosopher, whom Jung had known for over 25 years, vehemently attacked Jung as a Gnostic in print, wrote a rather mean attack on Jung and his Gnosticism as heresy, as a type of modern heresy. And, well, Jung had to give a reply. He did. He wrote a rather tepid reply, denying the theological epithet of Gnostic, essentially. And actually, if you read Jung's reply, if you know Jung and what was going on at that time, there are parts of his reply which are really quite funny. I mean, they aren't funny if you don't know what was going on with the man, but if you read them knowing what had been going on at this moment, some of the things he says are really, they were his own jokes to himself. At the time Jung wrote his reply to Buber, saying he wasn't going to take this theological epithet of Gnostic, he had laying on his desk beside him the manuscript of Answer to Job, perhaps the most extraordinary Gnostic, plainly Gnostic text he had ever written. It was sitting there waiting to be printed, which would be the ultimate evidence to some people of Jung's Gnosticism. And at the same time, he was writing on his desk, a foot away, this reply to Martin Buber. It's ridiculous in a way. But there was no dialogue to be had. The argument was not to be engaged. And at that particular moment, culturally, there was really no benefit in going that road, especially with a fellow of Martin Buber's standing and viewpoint. Well, that's one reason. And, you know, throughout the Jungian literature, one finds quotes from this reply to Buber in which Jung said, well, I'm not a Gnostic, quote unquote. Forget it. Just forget that. It has really no relevance. As John Dorley, who is a Catholic priest and Jungian analyst in Canada, who I think is well known to Stefan, John Dorley is an expert in some of this Buber-Jung controversy, and Dorley wrote, in an article published, I think, in 2003 in a Jungian journal, the Journal of Analytical Psychology, he said, you know, there was really only one reasonable answer that Jung should have given and could have given, but strangely did not give. And that answer was, so what's wrong with being a Gnostic? Well, you know, Dr. Heller and Dr. Alfred Ribby, the author of The Search for Roots, are in accord with that view. But there was another issue that came along. And that was after Jung's death, he was institutionalized. Of course, there were a lot of Freudians that thought Jung should have been institutionalized much earlier in life. But, you know, institutions have their own needs. And the institution, which became the forwarders, the representatives of Jung's tradition over the next generation, were within the Jungian analytical fold. And the idea sort of developed that you had to be a Jungian, Jungite. You had to go through analysis and all of that before you could really speak intelligently about Dr. Jung. But of course, Jungian analytical focus was on clinical issues. Well, you know, people don't spend $100,000 or more that it takes to become a Jungian analyst these days, along with at the same time taking vows of poverty. They have to go out into the world and make a living. And if you're going to go out in the world as a clinician with a clinical specialty, it must be a valid clinical specialty. And nominating Jung as a Gnostic prophet and yourself as a Gnostic practitioner is no particular way to get an insurance company like Blue Cross or Blue Shield, not that they pay you much anyway if you're a therapist, to pay you anything, right? I mean, it just takes the foundation right out of a clinical setting for Jungian psychology. But this was the foundation in the last 30, 40, 50 years to Jungian studies. Okay, so there's an issue there. But when you look at Jung, when you look at Jung's writings, when you look at who he was talking to, when you look at his friends, the people he was having stimulating intellectual conversations with, they were not therapists. They were not, for the most part, physicians or psychologists. They were some of the seminal figures of 20th century intellectual life. And you look at the list. You look at the list of the participants of the Uranos Forum, which went on from 1933, Jung's last visit there was in 1951. Over those years, an extraordinary elite, a cutting edge of 20th century culture was present there. Representatives of philosophy, of mythology, of studies in religion were coming, and these were the people Jung was talking to, really. These were the people Jung was befriending and having his beneficial intellectual interactions with. Karl Carini, Heinrich Zimmer, Mercy Eliade, Henri Corbin, Victor White, Father Victor White, the Dominican priest, and then later Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Kabbalah. These are the sorts of people that Jung was talking to. And influencing, I would add. A few years ago, I was invited to go to Zurich for a very unusual celebration. It was a party in memory of the 50th anniversary of the death of Jung, and it was held at Jung's Bollingen Tower. And while there, I met some people from the Jung Institute who knew of my interest in Gnosticism, And what they said to me is, you know, we haven't had anyone talk about Jung and Gnosticism here at the Institute in a long time. Would you come do that? So, yes, I would, of course. It took a couple years to arrange the schedule to go do it, and I went and did that last February. And prior to going, I was trying to arrange my notes, my thoughts from the last many years about Jung and Gnosis to present to a Jungian analytic community and training there in Zurich, specialists in this field, trying to knit it all together. And while I was going through, looking at the things I wanted to talk about, putting my own notes together, I came across a reference that I had never seen before. And that was to a book by an author by the name of Alfred Ribby, and it's actually a footnote that Dr. Shyam Dasani puts in the Red Book, right next to his citation of the Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons to the Dead by Stefan. He talks about another author who talked about Gnosticism and the Seven Sermons, and his name was Dr. Alfred Ribby. And the book was called Die Suche nach den eigenen Wurzeln in German, The Search for Our Roots or One's Roots. This was a hard book to find. And it took me a while to finally get a copy of this book. And before I went to Zurich, if there was any Jungian anywhere who was talking constructively about Jung and Gnosticism, I certainly wanted to know that before I started talking on this subject at the Institute, particularly when this figure had been at the Institute for 50 years, Dr. Ribby. So actually, Stefan and I sat down after breakfast for a few mornings and went through Ribby's book, with Stefan reading the German text and translating as he went. And this was an interesting book. I was quite surprised. So when I went to Zurich, before I arrived, I sent some emails to Dr. Ribby trying to get a hold of him through the Institute and asking him if we could get together. We did, shortly after I arrived in Zurich, get together. We went out and had coffee and ended up talking for 5 hours. And Dr. Ribby is born the same year that Dr. Heller was. I don't know if I should reveal that year. Is that...
Yeah.
It was a very long time ago. But a good year, a good vintage it was. So, and we ended up talking, and point after point after point of things that I had felt, that things that Stefan had said, Ribby was in complete agreement with these things. And, you know, I asked him, but does anyone else in the Jungian community get this? And he said, no. He said, it's been very lonely. And he talked about it at the psychological club in Zurich, but people, it was not their interest. And then I asked him about his book, The Search for Roots. And Ribby told me that indeed it had been translated. Somebody at the Institute had financed a translation of the book not too long after it was published. It was published in 1999, and he had worked on it for several years prior to that. But he said, you know, we couldn't find a Jungian publisher who was interested in printing it. They all thought it was too scientific, you know, sort of outside the realm of Jungian studies. It was too Gnostic stuff, and so no one wanted it. And he asked me, would you help me publish this book in English? And he handed me the translation. I said, sure, I will get this done. This is important. Why? Ribby, well, I didn't tell you a bit about his biography, I should have. Ribby's a medical doctor. After completing his medical training in the 1950s, he went through his own life crisis. And he entered the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich. He began his analysis in 1962 with Maria Luisa von Franz, who was Jung's principal disciple. And he was in his early 30s at that time. He went on to become the director of studies at the Jung Institute in 1969. He has been an examiner, a lecturer, a teacher, an analyst in Zurich for 50 years. He knew Marie-Louise von Franz as close as anyone could and worked with her all of her remaining life, 30 years. He knew Agnelli Affe. He knew Barbara Hanna. All of these people. He was right in the middle of the founding generation of the Jung Institute. No one knows the tradition of the C.G. Jung Institute and of Jung through his own disciples. No living person does better than Dr. Alfred Ribby. No one would question his credentials within the Jungian community. his learning, his understanding. And this man proclaimed that indeed Jung was a Gnostic, a modern Gnostic. This is a book, this is a declaration that needed to be shared. Now, if you think about it, what we have here now are bookends. And I think this is important if any of you are actually going to look at this book, get a copy and read it. First of all, I do suggest you first read The Gnostic Jung and The Seven Sermons to the Dead. It came first. And in some ways, it's a more approachable book for the general reader. Dr. Heller, as a Gnostic, approached Jung and saw the Gnostic roots in his psychology. Dr. Ribby had no interest in Gnosticism until he came to Jung. Through his reading of Jung, he discovered the centrality, of at least what appeared to be the centrality of the Gnostic tradition through Jung, through his study of the Jungian tradition, and then through that came to Gnosticism. Over the years, Dr. Ribby came to know Hilaire Quispel, the great initial scholar of Gnosticism, who had brought the first of the Nag Hammadi codices to the Jung Institute, I believe it was in 1953. And had also been a good friend of Jung's. This particular book was written at the instigation of Hilaire Quispel, who felt that Ribby had to write a book. But his book was not to be oriented to the psychological community. Quispel wanted somebody in the psychological community to write a book oriented towards Gnostic scholars, to let Gnostic scholars understand this experiential, psychological approach to the thing that they were doing. Because you see, in the 1960s and 70s, people were still just working, beginning at the translation of the Nag Hammadi text, yeah? So they needed to understand this textual material, the origins of it. Now think about that. So here you have a psychologist, Jungian, writing to the Gnostics, and here we have a Gnostic perhaps trying to help the Jungians understand Jung from a Gnostic viewpoint. Two very essential books. But, you know, the foundational experience, once again, behind both of these books' perception, that foundational experience was veiled from both authors. Dr. Ribby did not have the Red Book. He did not know all the details of what had happened to Jung during the years in which Liber Nullus was being compiled in journal and then transcribed into the Red Book. Neither did Dr. Heller. No one did. Both authors had recognized the sermons rising through the mist of history like a great mountain peak in the distance, and they intuited it as the source of many vital streams that flowed forth into Jung's work. But seen from the distance, it seemed isolated. It seemed an island, cut off from the rest of Jung's work in many ways. What they could not yet document is that this great peak rose from a vast continent of experience. And that rooted Jung in the Gnostic tradition. And ultimately, this land could not be explored until we had in hand the text of Jung's work, the Red Book, and now forthcoming also Jung's diaries, the Black Books. And the Black Book diaries, if any of you don't know this, are being prepared for publication and should be in print probably in about 3 years. So the question I had when I finally got my copy of the Red Book and started looking at this material is, were my own intuitions about this period substantiated? I had been developing ideas about what had been going on for quite a while. When did Jung first come to understand his own experience to have links or be founded in Gnostic tradition? Was this really the root? Was there documentary evidence to support the intuitions of people like Ribby and Heller and myself, ultimately? And so in the introduction, the foreword I wrote for Dr. Ribby's book, Ribby asked me to add in this material, to talk about how Jung's Liber Nullus helps us understand the Gnostic sources of his experience documented therein, and how that relates to this Gnostic identification of Jung. Jung the Gnostic. And so let me talk about that. And this is new material. Not many people have studied this. Not many people know about it. I put this in the foreword, and the foreword actually of the book, although it's 33 pages long, is very abbreviated. There's much more in this documentation. I can only cover a bit of it tonight. If you're interested, the entire foreword for the Ruby book is on the Gnosis.org website, free. If you want it, you can download it and read it. At least the foreword, the rest of the book you have to buy. Writing in 1950, Jung explained his situation 40 years earlier, at the threshold of the experience that produced Liber Novus. And I quote, "The psyche is not of today. Its ancestry goes back many millions of years. Individual consciousness is only the flower and the fruit of a season, sprung from the perennial rhizome beneath the earth. And it would find itself in better accord with the truth if it took the existence of the rhizome into its calculations. For the root matter is the mother of all things." End quote. The rhizome. Root. You know, a rhizome is a living root. Some plants have a rhizome, if you like the sacred acacia tree. I have one in my yard. I know about this very well. If you cut down the tree, the rhizome will send up new shoots. You can cut down what you see above the ground. Underneath the ground, it lives. It will send up new life. The perennial rhizome. Jung recounted that his intense study of mythologies around 1911, when he was working on von Lungenen's Symbole der Libido, forced him to conclude that without a myth, a human is, quote, "like one uprooted, who has no true link either with the past or with the ancestral life which continues within him, or yet with contemporary human society." He then continues to say, "So I suspected that myth had a meaning, which I was sure to miss if I lived outside of it, in the haze of my own speculations. I was driven to ask myself in all seriousness, what is the myth you are living? I found no answer to this question, and had to admit that I was not living with a myth, or even in a myth, but rather in an uncertain cloud of theoretical speculations, possibilities, which I was beginning to regard with increasing distrust. So, in the most natural way, I took it upon myself to get to know my myth, and I regarded this as the task of tasks. I simply had to know what unconscious or preconscious myth was forming me, from what rhizome I sprang." And so, beginning on the night of 12 November of 1913, 100 years minus 1 month ago, beginning on that night and continuing over the next several years, Jung confronted this portentous task of tasks. Jung stepped to the rim of the world where he declared the mirror image begins. He called it a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. And he found his myth. He found the rhizome, the root from which he sprang. As he explained, as reported in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, "The knowledge I was concerned with, or was seeking, still could not be found in the science of those days. I myself had to undergo the original experience. And moreover, try to plant the results of my experience in the soil of reality. Otherwise, they would have remained subjective assumptions without validity. End quote. And in 1948, in a very moving letter to his dear friend, Father Victor White, he wrote about this time in his life, "I wanted the proof of a living spirit, and I got it. Don't ask me at what price." That was his experience. So, Jung had felt this urgent need to understand the unconscious or preconscious myth that was forming him, the primordial root, which he was connected to. And so between November of 1913 and the spring of 1914, he began his extraordinary odyssey into the depths of the inner world. And of course, this is recorded in Liber Novus. This is Liber Primus and Liber Secundus of Liber Novus, this story. Though it was imaginative, though it was mythic, apparently fictive and ultimately subjective, this living spirit that Jung had confronted was met as an objective fact. It was independent. It was ineffably ancient, and yet intimately and synchronously connected with our human story, our human history. He perceived it as real, and the story it had told with the tenor of revelation. Tenor of revelation. And this experience placed a weighty burden upon him, a vocation. He needed to link what had happened to him, as he said, both the experience and the new book it produced, to its roots, to its history, to its place in the human record. Okay. Is that so difficult to understand? How when something like this would happen that you'd want to find, my God, am I the only one? Where else have my presumptions, my experiences occurred in the human record? Jung was in that situation. Just as I was editing this 5-hour lecture down to 2.5 hours, just as I was trying to edit it, well, maybe a little less, who knows. Last week, he laughs, he's watching my back and he's laughing. I received a letter, because for years I've been managing the Gnosis Archive, which some of you may have seen, gnosis.org. I get letters, and some very nice letters, actually. I get letters from people who are interested in Gnostic tradition. It's been going on for 20 years. I get crazy letters, too. I mean, there are crazy people, but some of the crazy letters are interesting. Anyway, I got a letter from a woman somewhere back east, and she was writing me to thank me for my lectures that I have on the internet. Most of the lectures I did on the Red Book and the lectures I did in Zurich, I just put them online. But I don't know how people find them. I put them there, but I have no idea how people end up finding them. So I thanked her for her nice letter thanking me, and I asked her, by the way, how did you come to this? I'm interested in, where people come from. And she wrote me a letter back, and I'd like to read it to you, because I think it may hit an element that some of you know. Okay? This is what she said. Before I read this, I asked her if I could read it. She gave me her permission to share this with you tonight. I had a Gnostic experience of my own, she writes, and had been searching for some sort of a framework to understand it, which led me to the Gnosis.org website in general and to your lectures and work in particular. Before my experience, I'd never heard of any of this stuff. Like Jung, I wanted to know if someone, somewhere, had experienced anything similar to what I had, before I chalked the whole thing up to mere insanity. Apparently, I'm not the only one to have had such an experience. The hermeneutic language of the Gnostics, the imagery evoked within the words of the Nag Hammadi texts and other similar texts, is exactly what I had experienced. I personally believe that many people have similar experiences. However, such an experience will literally shatter one's current view of the world, which is terrifying. I guess some people prefer the comfort of staying within the box of their current worldview to diving into the unknown depths of the psyche and spirit. If so, I wouldn't blame them. It is terrifying. Yet it is more than worth it. And she goes on. Before encountering the Gnostic writings, I'd read many accounts of people who had transcendent experiences. But it seemed that there was an underlying need for them to make that experience fit within their own box or worldview, as evidenced by the tone of their writings. The boundaries of their boxes may have been expanded after their experiences, but it remained a box nonetheless. Like that quote of Jung's, I didn't want to go back into the box hung on a little string. Anyway, until recently I'd been mostly focusing on the Nag Hammadi and Hermetic portions of the website, along with listening to Dr. Heller's lectures, which of course are also available online. I'd noticed that there was plenty of attention given to Jung on the home page of your website, but hadn't looked into all of it until recently. I have an academic background in psychology and was familiar with Jung's work on archetypes and the collective unconscious, but I had no idea about the source of all this. It is important to have a modern, recent example of someone else who went through this and accomplished so much afterwards. Jung, to me, more than any other modern Gnostic, was an example of a living philosopher's stone. I feel he truly achieved the goal of the great work, using his own psyche as the crucible. Have any of you been in that situation of feeling that you were absolutely crazy? That there were things going on that no one understood? That you were all alone? You know, over the years, I've had letters like that at the Gnosis Archive. In fact, she finishes her letter with this sentence. She says, "Not many people that I know have ever heard of the Gnostics. So it can feel isolating at times." You know, yes, it can. Dr. Jung, Carl Gustav Jung, in 1914, 1915, was not in such a different human circumstance, you know? Of course, what he had undergone was extraordinary, beyond the bounds of what most of us would ever endure, I suspect. He needed to find a place where this had happened in history, people who knew what this was, so that he was not alone, so this was just not his subjective experience. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung explained his situation. At the time, he was completing the first draft of Liber Novus, around 1915. He says, "First, I had to find evidence for the historical prefiguration of my inner experiences. That is to say, I had to ask myself, where have my particular premises already occurred in history? Where are my friends? Where are my fellows in this event?" Okay? And he goes on, "If I had not succeeded in finding such evidence, I would have never been able to substantiate my ideas." You know, when these events come, be they intense dreams, spontaneous visionary material, intense feelings of a sense of connection to a story that we can't even explain, we do need context for them. Otherwise, they can just float away without any constructive effect in our lives. By recognizing historical roots, Dr. Jung gave substance and sustenance to his psychology, he said. And the first place he found those roots was, he says, in the Gnostic writers. Memories, Dreams, Reflections records that he undertook his study of the Gnostic writers between 1918 and 1926. Now that date, given in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, because I'd studied this for years, always seemed off. He wrote the Seven Sermons to the Dead in 1916. You're telling me he just started studying the Gnostics in 1918? It seemed like something was going on much earlier than that. And indeed it was. That date in Memory Stream's Reflections is wrong. And there are quite a few things in Memory Stream's Reflections as edited by Anil Yaffe which are not quite right. Frau Yaffe later corrected that date in another lecture to 1916, which is still a year too early. Dr. Sonu Shamdasani has now documented that Jung began his study, in close study, of the Gnostic writers in January of 1915 when he was on military service, and then continued further with that study in October of 1915. This is 1 year, 1 year after the intense central experiences of the Red Book. He was searching within that first year, after first completing his draft of Liber Novus, he was searching for the root of this experience in history. You know, this period of Jung's life has been his greatest enigma. He described it as the numinous beginning which contained everything. But until very recently, we knew really next to nothing about it. Disclosure of these primary records, including the Black Books and Liber Novus, now make it possible for us to understand what was indeed happening. And without comprehending what happened to Jung during these years, I do not believe we can possibly grasp the motivation and focus of his later life's work. Jung told Barbara Hanna, a close associate who he knew for probably from the late 1920s onward, Jung told Barbara Hanna repeatedly, and this is what he said, as quoted by Barbara Hanna in her biography of Jung, "He told me more than once that the first parallels he found to his own experience were in the Gnostic texts. That is, in those reported in Alenkos of Hippolytus." Alenkos of Hippolytus. The Alenkos of Hippolytus. Dr. von Franz independently confirmed this statement as true to Dr. Ribby. The first place Jung found parallels of his experiences were in the writings of Hippolytus, which are known as Alenkos, and the refutation of all heresies. Alenkos is the Greek abbreviation of the title. Hippolytus had written around the year 200 to 230. And note that what Jung said is that he had found a parallel of his experiences in the writings of Hippolytus. He didn't say he'd found parallel concepts or similar ideas. He said he'd found a reflection of his experience. It's a bit different. So the question I had, reading that, looking back into this material, are when did Jung read Hippolytus? This is the first place he found the Gnostic writers. When did it happen? When was it? And second, what were the specific experiences he saw mirrored in those writings? His own experiences he saw mirrored in the Gnostic writings. Okay. Well, first of all, Hippolytus' refutation of all heresies, which is cited by Jung with the Greek abbreviated title Alenkos, had only been discovered at Mount Athos in Greece in 1842. It had been lost for many, many years until it was rediscovered. A generally recognized value of Hippolytus' Alenkos is that it contains abundant quotations from 2nd century Gnostic texts that were otherwise lost, otherwise unknown. So, here's the evidence. Jung, by 1915, is reading the Gnostic texts. We have that documented. January and October of 1915. He says the first Gnostic texts that made sense to him were the texts in Hippolytus. These were where found his experiences mirrored. So my question then was, well, what books was he reading? And I suspected that there were two books that he might have been reading at this time that I knew were in his library. One was G.R.S. Mead, the great theosophical historian and scholar of Gnosticism, who had written Fragments of a Faith Forgotten, and several other things, and published it in 1900 and 1906. I knew Jung had this. There was another book he cited called Dokumente der Gnosis by Wolfgang Schulz, a German, which was essentially the same material that Mead had used. And it was basically quotations from the heresiologists, from Hippolytus, etc. So I was talking to Dr. Shamdasani about this, and he suggested that why don't I just go to Jung's library when I'm in Zurich and look at Jung's books and see which one he marked. And when I went to Zurich, what I was looking for is to see, you know, what was the book Jung had been reading? And Andreas was very kind and invited me over for a couple of afternoons of long conversations in Jung's library and to go through his books. And I found something quite extraordinary.
Andreas is the grandson.
Oh, yeah. Andreas, I should mention these names. Yeah. Andreas Jung is the son of Herr Franz Jung, Jung's only son. So he's the grandson of Jung, and he occupies Jung's home at 228 Seestrasse in Kunsnach. He's been the keeper of the home now, lives there. So I thought the book Jung had been reading was probably going to be G.R.S. Mead's Fragments of a Faith Forgotten, which is a remarkable account of Gnostic texts, of pretty much everything important known prior to Nag Hammadi. But when I went through Jung's copy of Mead in the library, Jung really had not marked it very much. Occasionally in his books, Jung would make marginalia. You know, he'd mark important passages and that were important to him. But he only marked a few books. Maybe Andreas Jung told me that he thought only maybe 80 or 100 books had marking. Dr. Shamdasani said, no, that's wrong. More of the important books to Jung. He had marked some. So I thought maybe when I went through G.R.S. Mead, I'd find that Jung had marked the book up. And when I went through Jung's copy, sitting at Jung's desk of G.R.S. Mead, it was really not much marking. Then I went looking for this book, Wolfgang Schulz. If you look at the frontispiece of this book, it's got a remarkable woodcut art. I had actually gotten an electronic copy of this book before I went to Zurich. You see this figure over here? This snake with a lion's head? There was this vision Jung had, which he recounts in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. When his encounter with Salome and Elijah, he had been wrapped by the snake and he had taken on the head of a lion. I looked at that and thought, well, geez, that, I suspect if Jung would have seen that, it would have attracted his attention. This is a copy, a little larger copy that I colorized a bit for the cover of the book. When I pulled Dokumente der Gnosis off of Jung's shelf, where he has all his Gnostic collection, and opened it, I was absolutely shocked. Dr. Jung had underlined or marginally marked almost every page in this book, unlike any other book in his 4,000-volume collection, as best I could ascertain. When Jung read this book, it really broke something open. And I just have to tell you, holding the book, flipping page by page through it, seeing page by page by page of markings, and knowing that he had not done this with any other book, this book really broke something open for the man. Another thing about this image is that the image has a strange similarity with the image of Izdubar in the Red Book. You'll notice these little crocodile-like figures here to the side. The crocodiles here, and here. The symmetry of the picture. Of course, the two fish, the Aeon of Pisces. And at the top, this eight-rayed star above the head of Izdubar, the same sort of eight-rayed star emerging from a vessel. But you see, there's another thing here. This is historical stuff, I admit, but it's detective work. Jung dated the picture of Izdubar, December of 1915. That's one of the first dates in the Red Book. He painted this in December of 15. We knew he was studying the Gnostic materials in January and October of 1915 based on his notebooks. We know that this particular book, Dokumente der Gnosis, is perhaps the most heavily marked book in his library. This was probably the book that broke it open for him. So what's in it? Lots of quotations from Hippolytus. Gnostic texts preserved by Hippolytus. You know, there are, of course, many other sources which Jung would have read, but I think this was the book that really cracked it open for him sometime in that first year after the Red Book had started. G.R.S. Mead's Fragments of a Faith Forgotten was one of the books Jung would have undoubtedly turned to quickly. Mead's work presents much the same material that's in Schulz's book, but does so in much greater detail with a more astute psychological commentary. And Schulz, in the foreword to his book, expresses his debt to Mead. He says that his book contains much of what Mead's book had contained, but he comments the German translation of Mead's book was not so good. Schulz's book, of course, is in German. So, when did Jung start studying Gnostic material? Evidence suggests strongly it was in the very beginning years of writing the Red Book. Within 1 year of the beginning, because most of this stuff starts in December 1913. In January of 1915, 1 year, 1 month later, he's reading stuff like this. And what's he reading it for? Why? He's looking for evidence of an experience similar to his own in history. Is that making sense to you? You see the connection I'm trying to make here? Yeah? Okay. And he's reading G.R.S. Mead. In fact, on his bookshelf there in his library, he has every work of Mead on the bookshelf. Every work, including Mead's journal, The Quest, which went from 1909 to 1930. He's got the complete series of Mead's Quest journals. Everything that Mead had written, he has right there. He was reading this stuff. But I think this book, Schulz's book, was the first one that cracked it open. Okay. So, this is the text he was reading. What are the stories in here that he was reading? Hippolytus, yes, there are quotations. Long sections of Hippolytus are in Schulz's book and in G.R.S. Mead's book, Fragments of a Faith Forgotten. And I should tell you, both of these books are available on the internet if you want to go looking for them. You can look at them. Fragments of a Faith Forgotten, one of the finest books before Nag Hammadi you'll find. One of the finest books on Gnosticism still to this day, 100 years later. You should read it. It's an excellent. Jung himself said it was a book written with great love and understanding. He said, there is nothing in German equal to this work by G.R.S. Mead. Quote, Jung. So, I would suggest to you that there are two stories, two experiences, and perhaps many more as well that I could bring about, but for the purposes of this lecture, two experiences that Jung identified within the Gnostic writings that he encountered in 1915. The first is the story of Sophia and the Demiurge, and the second is the story of Simon Magus and his consort Helena. Both tales subsequently entwine themselves in parts of Liber Novus composed after 1915. So, the published edition of Liber Novus includes three appendices provided as an integral part of the superb editorial apparatus that Dr. Sonu Shamdasani constructed for the book. Each appendix gives a glimpse into Jung's journal accounts, and they are really indispensable for understanding the mythic framework within sections of Liber Novus composed after 1915, the months during which Jung was confronting his own roots in Gnostic tradition. The third appendix, Appendix C, I think, is the most extraordinary. And here I should add, Dr. Shamdasani chose these texts. I mean, you know, he had a vast amount of material to put into Liber Novus. And he decided to choose three texts for an appendix that he thought were critical for this printed edition of the book. And of course, when the Red Book was printed, Dr. Shamdasani had absolutely no idea whether anything else from this early date would be published, whether the black books would be published or anything. So in his editorial apparatus, if you look at it, there's a vast amount of material, a guide to the black book journals, and then these appendices that he thought had to be part of this record. Okay, Appendix C reproduces Jung's words written in his black book journal, Black Book 5, on the night of 16 January, 1916. Now, just for reference, this is 2 weeks before Jung would write the Seven Sermons to the Dead in his journal. 2 weeks before, okay? January 1916. And this is about 5 or 6 months or maybe more after he's been reading the Gnostic material. And it is an astounding text in which the feminine voice of Jung's soul reveals to him the story that will be recognized by every student of Gnosticism as the foundational myth of the tradition. The story of Sophia and the Demiurge. If there is a monomyth, a central myth in Gnostic tradition, it is the story of the Demiurge and Sophia. In classic Gnostic mythology, Sophia, or wisdom, was a feminine aeon, a twin archetype or a syzygy of the masculine logos. She is the feminine aspect of divinity, which was indwelling cosmos and creation. Much like the anima mundi of alchemical myth, Sophia is present within the very tissue of cosmos and consciousness. In the Gnostic drama of creation, an abortive emanation has separated from Sophia soon after her entry into the depths of the coming cosmos. This is a complex myth, and I can't explain it all. I'll just go just that far. This abortive force, this defective child, grew into a fiery cosmic force that falsely claimed to be the singular and supreme deity. As self-declared ruler of the material world, he sought to hold humanity in his thraldom, in slavery. This was the Demiurge. Gnostic myths gave him many different names, including Soklos, Yaldabaoth. Jung chose a Gnostic name, Abraxas, to describe the Demiurge. In the oft-restated Gnostic myth, Sophia was the opponent of the Demiurge. She was the higher power who sought to awaken in humankind knowledge of their intrinsic light and origin, thereby liberating them from the deceitful worldly lordship of the Demiurge. Okay? Classic Gnostic myth. It comes in various recensions throughout the Non-Shamadi material and ancient sources as well that were available long before. Sources that were available to Jung in these books he had in his library in 1915. So over the past century, most scholars of Gnosticism have argued that absent a myth of the Demiurge, a mythology should not properly be called a Gnostic mythology, at least in a classical sense. And this subject has colored some past interpretations of the Seven Sermons to the Dead, Septem Sermones ad Mortuos. Occasional critics have contended that Jung's sermons do not explicitly include the story of the Demiurge. Thus, it is suggested Jung did not understand the core of Gnostic mythology, and the sermons are not a true exemplar of Gnostic mythology or a mythologem. However, it is now fully manifest that this critique results from a misreading, and it's easy to see how that misreading could occur, because this is a complex passage in the Seven Sermons where Jung talks about Abraxas and the Demiurge, that this is a misreading of the second sermon of Jung's Seven Sermons. This is all made clear in Jung's journal entry from 16 January 1916. This is what is written there. In this journal entry, Jung records the following words spoken to him by the soul, who assumes the voice of Sophia. Her address is unarguably a rendition of the primal Gnostic myth of the Demiurge, here named Abraxas. And I read you, I quote, this is the feminine voice speaking to Jung as recorded in his journal. You should worship only one God. The other gods are unimportant. Abraxas is to be feared. Therefore, it was a deliverance when he separated himself from me. And let me add there, that's a key quote in understanding what Jung's saying here. Note the soul is here taking the voice of Sophia talking to Jung, the separation of the demiurge from Sophia, when he separated himself from me, is a key part of this ancient Gnostic myth. So then the voice continues. You do not need to seek him. He will find you, just like Eros. He is the god of the cosmos, extremely powerful and fearful. He is the creative drive. He is form and formation, just as much matter and force. Therefore, he is above all light and dark gods. He tears away souls and casts them into procreation. He is the creative and the created. He is the God who always renews himself in days, in months, in years, in human life, in ages, in people, in the living, in heavenly bodies. He compels. He is unsparing. If you worship him, you increase his power over you. Thereby it becomes unbearable. You will have a dreadful time getting clear of him. So remember him, but do not worship him. But do not also imagine that you can flee him, since he is all around you. You must be in the middle of life, surrounded by death on all sides, stretched out like one crucified. You hang in him, the fearful, the overpowering. But you have in you the one God, the wonderful, beautiful, and kind, the solitary, star-like, unmoving, he who is older and wiser than the Father, he who has a safe hand, who leads you among all the darknesses and death scares of dreadful Abraxas. He gives joy and peace, since he is beyond death and beyond what is subject to change. He is no friend and no servant of Abraxas. End quote. This journal entry unambiguously identifies the figure of Abraxas, who shortly thereafter, 2 weeks later, appears in the Seven Servants to the Dead as the demiurge of classical Gnostic mythology. Jung knew the Gnostic provenance of this myth. He recognized it. A Sophianic voice had declared to him the fundamental Gnostic assertion, you have in you the one God, the wonderful, the beautiful, and kind, the solitary, star-like, and unmoving. And Jung turned to that star, and it became his life guide. Now one should note this basic declaration of the story of the demiurge had already appeared in another form in Jung's writings. You see, I said that Jung was looking for a method of understanding what had happened to him, an analog in history for what had happened to him. Early in the Red Book, in parts of the Red Book transcribed months before this, Jung had talked about a spirit of the times and a spirit of the depths. You'll remember in the Red Book.
Liber 1.
Yeah, in Liber Primus, the first book, Jung finished this section of the Red Book much earlier. And in the preamble he penned on the first pages of the Red Book, Jung confronts two powers, the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths. The spirit of the time unmistakably manifests as a demiurge, declaring in the fashion typical of the Gnostic demiurge that there is no other power before him. The spirit of the depths rebuffs the demiurge's claimed sovereignty and entreats Jung to look beyond his fabrications. What Jung encounters and records 2 years later, in 1916, is not a new theme. Rather, it is a metamorphosis in voice, in vocabulary, and in the mythological identification of his guides. In 1916, Gnostic mythology has become a symbolic vessel for Jung's experience. Okay? Now this amazing text from Black Book 5, this Sophianic story, is not in the Red Book. Jung did not transcribe this into his calligraphic volume or into his drafts for the calligraphic volume. Obviously it is central Shamdasani saw it as central enough to put it as one of the three appendices. The other,
It's not in scrutinies, but in the appendix.
It's in the appendix. It's not. Jung did not put it in his transcription of the material he was going to transcribe into the Red Book. It is in his private diary. The other thing that the other appendices, you know, if you look at what Shamdasani added, it was the Systema Mundi Totius, of which Dr. Heller has spoken, a Gnostic aeonology, as it might be described. This also came in the same few weeks of 1916, and then the seven sermons come. In 1916, in January, the beginning of this year, within the first year and months that Jung is working on the Red Book, this Gnostic mythology is entering in to his self-identification, his mythos, his root. So I would suggest to you, based upon my reading of this history, based upon documentation, I think, which is very sound, in 1916, Jung had seemingly found the root of his myth. And it was the myth of Gnosis. And I see no evidence that that ever changed. Over the next 40 years, he would proceed to construct an interpretive reading of the Gnostic tradition's occult course across the Christian aeon. In Hermeticism, in alchemy, in Kabbalah, in Christian mysticism, and in this vast hermeneutical enterprise, Jung was building a bridge. A bridge across time, leading back to the foundation stone of classical Gnosis. The bridge that led forward into a new and coming aeon was footed on the stone rejected by the builders 2,000 years ago. That's one part of the experiences I think that Jung saw reflected in Gnostic material that he found in his own experience prior to encountering the Gnostic material, and then which he put into the vocabulary of Gnostic myth thereafter, 1914, 1915, 1916. There's another, and I don't have time, well, unless you want to stay till midnight. No takers. Oh. Weaklings. Okay. There's another myth, and I talk about this in the foreword to the book. Once again, you can download it and read it. And that's the story. This other, and I think this is actually very important, of Philemon, of Simon Magus, and Helena. Okay. Once again, let me just give you this timeline of what happened to Jung during these years. These are the things we did not know. We did not know any of this until 4 years ago, and really, hardly anyone knows it now because it. Reading this material, putting it into context with all of Jung's collected work, with all the rest of his biography, is a complex task. And some of us were a bit had a head start on this because we had been looking towards it for years and years and years, understanding some of this stuff before the Red Book came. So here we have Jung and his Sophianic vision, the voice of Sophia speaking to Jung. 2 weeks later, he writes the seven sermons to the dead in his journal. This he transcribes into the Red Book manuscript in 1917, another year later. And there he adds a homily between himself and Philemon. Well, who was Philemon? If you've read Jung's Memories, Dreams, Reflection, his autobiography, you'll encounter this very strange fellow Jung describes as his ghostly guru. A spirit, Philemon, with whom Jung walked in his garden and had conversations. And Jung said Philemon taught him things he didn't know. Philemon was extremely important to Jung as his teacher throughout these years. He appears in the Red Book first in January of 1914, where he is called the magician, the old magician Philemon. Well, when I got my Red Book and read through, getting to the seven sermons, the first thing we encounter is that the seven sermons to the dead, these are the summary revelation to the Red Book. These occur in the last pages of Jung's compilation of the Red Book. Written in 1970, this is Jung's summary. He said it was a prelude of all he had to offer to the world, and it was. This was Jung's summary. The seven sermons to the dead are just as important as Dr. Stefan Heller intuited 30 and more years ago when he wrote the Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons of the Dead. They are as important as Dr. Alfred Ribby in Zurich saw them to be 30 years ago and more, 40 years ago when he started his own study. I should rephrase that, 50 years ago. Ribby started studying the Gnostic Nagamati materials in 1964, right when he entered the Jung Institute, because he understood that this was central to Jung. From the very beginning, he had seen this and worked on it for 50 years. Alone, isolated. No one seemed interested. No one else sees it. There he was. And here we've been. Okay? At the end of the Red Book, it is revealed that Simon Magus was Philemon. Or Philemon was Simon Magus. Now that's strange if you don't know who Simon Magus is, if you don't know who Philemon is. Okay. At the very end of the Red Book, Jung has a vision. He's walking in his garden with Philemon, his spirit guide, and the Lord Christ appears. Philemon addresses Christ, my master, my brother. Christ addresses Philemon, but he says, Simon Magus, is that you? And Philemon replies, once I was Simon Magus, but now I've become Philemon. Holy Basil turd. Philemon is Simon Magus. Do you get... Well, who was Simon Magus? Let me tell you who he was. If you've ever been to I suppose that there must be somewhere a modern Gnostic church. And if there were to be such a church, I suppose that if there was a litany of saints someplace in that celebration, you know, as there are in traditional ecclesiastical celebrations, that in that litany of saints, if you were to have a litany, Simon might properly be the first historical name. Simon Menander. Yes. Said, oh, he is. Oh, yes. How about that? He is. Simon. You know, in... Irenaeus was one of the first Christian fighters of heresy, living in the late 2nd century. And Irenaeus identifies Simon as the father of all heresy, the first Gnostic. Simon's the first Gnostic, and Simon is Philemon? Interesting, isn't that? This is what Irenaeus said. The Samaritan Simon from whom all heresies took their origin. Okay, that's Simon. And he recounts both Simon's history and quotes writings attributed to him. But you know, the very best source on Simon Magus is Hippolytus. Hippolytus preserves most of Simon Magus's material in best form. And oh, yes, Jung had this material in 1950. Not only that, he had another interesting book in his library that I found. G.R.S. Mead, again, the Theosophical historian and Gnostic historian, wrote a book called Simon Magus, dedicated to Magus, the tradition of Simon Magus, and all his textual tradition from all the ancient known sources. He published it in 1896. Well, I was quite interested to pull this book off of C.G. Jung's bookshelf, too, when I was in Zurich, right? Because I knew at that point that he had thought that Philemon was Simon Magus, and I suspected this might be an interesting book to look at. Well, it was. I took the book down, it's a big format book, looked through it. There weren't any markings on it except on the first page. It had a library stamp. The library stamp was from the H.P. Blavatsky Theosophical Lodge in London. Jung's copy of this book of Simon Magus had been borrowed, God knows how, from this elite Theosophical Lodge in London and never returned. The HPV Lodge. Helena Petrovna Blavatsky Lodge. So I showed this to Jung's grandson, and he thought, my God, what are the overdue fees? You know, good Swiss reaction. So he didn't return it? Well, okay. So, Now, there are many things, many reasons why, besides the name, besides the historical identification, that Jung would have identified with Philemon and with Simon Magus as his forefather. And I don't have time to go into those teachings tonight, but in the foreword I go through several elements in the writings of Simon Magus, as preserved by Hippolytus, as transmitted to Jung by G.R.S. Mead, by Wolfgang Schultz, that he would have found very compatible with his own psychology and his own experience, in 1915. And 1916. And so, 2 years after the beginning of the journey of Liber Novus, Jung was now placing his visionary experience in an interpretive form impregnated by his reading of Gnostic mythology. In his journal entry from January of 1916, the soul speaks in the vocabulary of Gnostic myth. 2 weeks later, the same vocabulary enters into the initial journal formulation of the seven sermons to the dead. In the summer of 1916, his guide Philemon is revealed to be Simon Magus, the first Gnostic heretic. Jung's myth had met its root, its rhizome, and he knew it. He knew it. Let me show you one other thing. This is a painting that I think none of you have probably ever seen. It's a very rare painting. It was done at the same time Jung was working on the Red Book. He titled this painting Septem Sermonis Ad Mortuos, The Seven Sermons to the Dead. This is his painting dedicated to that experience. He gave this painting as a private gift to Peter Baines, who had translated the seven sermons into English. And Baines kept this for the rest of his life as a private treasure. He handed it on to his daughter, who possesses it now. It's only been published in a very small copy once. If you look at this picture, look at it closely. The seven sermons to the dead, the cross, the circle. Jung making that offering of the seven sermons to the dead. A prelude of what he had to offer our time. A very interesting painting. But this is what I wanted to show you after that. This is page 154 and 155 of Liber Novus. Jung added the transcription and the art to Liber Novus long after he had done the original transcription of the text. You know, he had these experiences in 1914 to 1916. He compiled a manuscript. Then he spent 16 more years taking his manuscript and calligraphically transcribing it into the Red Book and adding the art. And he never finished it. As he went along, the art represents his imagination, his re-encounter, his reliving of the experience at each episode as he went through the years. This painting of Philemon and Sapientia, Sophia, appears on page 154 and 155 of the Red Book. The painting of Philemon follows his transcription of his great ode, his great poem to Philemon in the Red Book. Here they are a little bit closer up. In 1924, when Jung painted these pictures, he was pretty much finished thematically with his Red Book. He would only over the next several years transcribe about 16 more pages into the book. This was the year in which his soul stopped talking to him and stopped being recorded in his journal. It's the year his mother died. It's the year he started his tower in Bollingen, his next work after the Red Book. I believe these pages present Jung's summary statement on his experience and his guides up until that time. The first, a masculine figure, Philemon, also known as Simon Magus, the magician. Above Simon's picture, in the Red Book, in Greek, and this has long been available if you had a magnifying glass to look at the picture, It says, "Beloved Philemon, father of the prophets." Beloved Philemon, father of the prophets. To the side, next, we have a picture of a woman. And above it, it says, Dei sapientia in mysterio. The wisdom of God, the Sophia of God in mystery. Sophia. Simon had a bride, Helen, an incarnation of Sophia. Simon, Magus, Philemon, the guide, Sapientia, Sophia, the wisdom of God in mystery. I believe this is a summary of Jung's experience, and I believe it adds to the whole an image of his Gnostic identification, of his root, of his rhizome, of the thing that had risen to new life in him. At the end of his life, Jung tried to finish the Red Book. It was important enough to him. As an old man in 1957 and 58, he took it out again and tried to finish the transcription, but his hand was too weak, his eyes too weak, he too old, and finally it was done. And it waited for us now, for this time, so that we might understand who this man was. We might begin to understand the whole of C.G. Jung. I would add, Jung did not use the writings of the Gnostics as sources for his psychology. He turned to the Gnostic accounts seeking confirmatory resources that supported his observations, his experiences of the mythopoetic depths underlying consciousness. Whatever his sympathies, Jung was not an ancient Gnostic. Not an ancient Gnostic. And he could not model himself in that archaic mode. He was a modern man. Perhaps even the first truly modern man. But establishing the link between the gnosis of old and his new praxis was an undertaking with a hidden and intensely personal and important significance to C.G. Jung. In Liber Novus, Carl Gustav Jung received a vocation that burdened him with an epical task, and this is what he wrote there. To give birth to the ancients in a new time is creation. This is the creation of the new, and that redeems me. Salvation is the resolution of the task. The task is to give birth to the old in a new time. To understand more than this and that of Jung, it is imperative we now ponder the way he worked the redemptive task of giving birth to the old in a new time. It is a complex enterprise. It demands the conjoint consideration of old traditions and of a new book. In the labor, prior assumptions and obscuring accretions will need to be stripped away. And the nature of Jungian studies will be changed. They will be changed. Nonetheless, by delving into the depths of Jung's relationship with this tradition, we will unearth a key that unlocks the transformative perspectives on Jung's hermeneutics of creative imagination, on his vision of a coming new chapter in the human story, and on our own experience, our own knowing of what it is to be human. I think that Dr. Heller made a signal and foundational contribution to that effort over 3 decades ago. Dr. Ribby, in his own way, speaking from a different venue, has added to that contribution. These are foundational works. More will come. Many more will come, but they will rest upon that foundation. Thank you very much.